this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Job Program Delivers 25% Hiring Rate. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. About one in four applicants to a community college program in which coursework is designed for a specific company end up working for that company. While a seemingly low ratio, many familiar with the customized training program give it nothing but praise. It is one of the state's single best competitive advantages when attracting new business, says Gary Salamito, Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce. It's clearly one of the leading customized training programs in the country, if not the world. It's exceptionally well done. The program operates through the North Carolina Community College System and works with private industries to screen and train workers. It receives $12.4 million in state appropriations, and because it is so closely tied to job creation, it gets that money directly from the legislature instead of having it funneled through the college system's budget. Furthermore, any funds that aren't spent in 1 year roll over to the following year. For the most recent year, 2011 to 2012, the program saw upticks nearly across the board, including in projects and trainees, while reducing the amount it spent per trainee, according to the program's annual report. As for where trainees end up, one in four applicants, not graduates, get jobs with the company for which the coursework was established, points out Maureen Little, Associate Vice President of the Customized Training Program. She says she does not have data on how many program graduates are hired. Under its initial purpose, the program worked largely with the North Carolina Department of Commerce to help attract businesses here. The program would offer to screen potential employees and train them on some of the specific skills required for the job. Salamito worked for the drug manufacturer that now has the name GlaxoSmithKline, which has North American headquarters in Research Triangle Park, in the 1990s and 2000s, and says the company's decision to expand in Zebulon hung in no small part on the training program. The customized training program was essential to that decision, he says, noting that a vaccine plant built by pharmaceutical company Novartis also benefited from the program. At the end of coursework, companies conduct job interviews to decide to whom to offer employment, even if a candidate had successfully completed the program. More recently, the program has been expanded to include the training of existing employees in new technologies and for projects aimed at enhancing productivity. We are continuing to see an increase from both existing industry and new industry who are recognizing that the only way they can be globally competitive is to have a well-skilled and well-trained workforce, says Little. Because tax money pays to train workers for private companies, the program can be seen as corporate welfare on a purely theoretical level, says Jay Shalin, who researches higher education policy for the John William Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, a conservative think tank. The world, however, is not purely theoretical, he points out, so you're trying to ask not just whether corporate welfare is bad, but what is the proper degree of cooperation between public schools and private employers. That degree of cooperation differs from project to project, explains Little. If, for example, a training program for one company would yield good job skills for a different company, Little and her team might decide the greater value to North Carolina's workforce is to pick up more of the tab. By contrast, if a particular program would have little benefit to workers seeking other jobs, then the community college system might ask the private employer to shoulder more of the cost. Of course, investments vary from county to county as well. What Anson County might consider as a huge investment, Wake County might not, she says. So it is going to vary from county to county, and we take that into consideration. We look at those counties that are economically distressed and determine what is going to be appropriate for that county or business. And our second article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal is in the middle of the page. It has a black border around it. Inside that border, the top third is a picture of a woman sitting on the arm of a couch in business dress, and the caption reads, Lennar's Trish Hanchett says multi-generational options are a runaway success. And then under that in bold black lettering is the headline, For All the Ages, Home Plans Offered for Boomerangs and Boomers. And this article was written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. As more Triangle families try to make room for the adult child moving back home or the aging parent moving in, home builders in the region are adding a new amenity to their home design options, more privacy. National builders, including Lennar, Pulte Group, KB Home, and Ashton Woods Homes, have been rolling out new floor plans over the past year to appeal to the multi-generational household. Options include the likes of a first-floor master suite in a front corner of the house, or a second master suite on an upper floor to accommodate more adults than has been traditional in American homes, at least over the past century. In 2010, nearly 5% of the family households in North Carolina consisted of three or more generations, according to U.S. Census data, and that's higher than the national average of 4% of the U.S. population. We think it's not a moment too soon, says Joan Pelletier, director of Triangle J's Area Agency on Aging, after touring Lennar's next-gen home model that opened recently in the Traditions at Bella Casa community in Apex. In Apex, Lennar has built a 3,700-square-foot model home priced at $414,000 that includes a 571-square-foot suite that resembles an extended-stay hotel room with its own bedroom, bathroom, living space, kitchenette, and front door access. Other floor plan options that Lennar plans to offer in the Triangle region range from 2,880 to 4,000 square feet. The Miami-based home building company began offering its next-gen models in Arizona about 2 years ago, followed by expansions into California and Texas, says Lennar Raleigh Division President Trish Hanchett, and they're finally making their way into North Carolina. This has been a runaway success on the West Coast, and all the divisions are lining up to roll it out, she says. Pelletier says that as the area's senior population continues to grow in numbers, so will the need for more housing to support their needs. Triangle J estimates that nearly 29% of people over age 65 living in the Triangle live alone. The concept of a separate dwelling that's close to family members is a good thing, she says. The wealthier individuals will be able to afford care, and Medicare takes care of the people needing skilled nursing, but for the folks in the middle, it's really challenging. The multi-generational home design options have been popular among Triangle residents with Indian and Asian heritage, Hanchett says. They want the extra bedroom and bath downstairs for when their family comes to see them for extended periods of time, she says. This takes it one step further. According to census data, more than 9% of Black and Asian households are multi-generational. Hampton Pitts, executive vice president of Ashton Woods Home, says he wouldn't offer a home design with more than 4,000 square feet without the option of converting at least one room into an in-law suite. A 4,844-square-foot model home that Ashton Woods will open in December in its new Leesville Crest community in North Raleigh will have an in-law suite, he says, with its own living room and kitchenette. 5 or 6 years ago, we would have a plan or two with that option, but today you have to have it, he says. Likewise, Pulte Group's Amberley Village Square community in Cary offers a plan with first-floor guest suites, and KB Home offers floor plans that include junior suites. KB Home spokeswoman Cara Kane says the plans have been popular among both multi-generational families and households with a boomerang child who wants additional privacy and his or her own bathroom. While most of the target audience for multi-generational designs has been for families adding more roommates, Hanchett says she's also discovered other uses for the spaces, including room for adult children with special needs, a nanny, a caregiver, or even a need for additional space for workout equipment or a man cave. This takes the mother-in-law suite one step further and gives the family an option for private space while still being able to join the rest of the family when you want to, says Hanchett. And there's one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Triangle Banks Still Not Lending, New Data Show. The Triangle banking market still hasn't quite escaped the doldrums into which it fell during the double whammy of a financial crisis and the Great Recession. Updated numbers compiled by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation for 7 area community banks show that net outstanding loans fell by 0.44% to $3.13 billion for the 12 months ending September 30th. Meanwhile, at the regional bank level, Raleigh-based First Citizens showed a 3.9% drop in net loans outstanding during the same period. The decline happened at both the half-dozen banks that First Citizens has acquired over the past 3 years and at the Legacy Bank as well. Observers peg the trend to continuing industry caution about making new loans to replace maturing ones and or shaky loan demand. In addition, bankers, especially at the community bank level, find themselves still working through a pile of troubled loans, many of them real estate related. It's the same pattern we've been seeing for some time now, says bank analyst Don Coker. The banks are still being cautious, but so are borrowers. It is the fiscal cliff. Is it the fiscal cliff? I don't know, but a lot of businesses just don't want to put themselves out there right now. Not all Triangle Community Banks saw loan contraction. At Raleigh-based business lender Capstone, which recently announced that it will acquire Patriot State Bank in Fuquay Varina, loan volume shot up by 15% to $161 million during the 12 months ending September 30. Capstone CEO Mike Patterson says the bank's new Cary Loan Production Office, which will become a full-service branch early next year, helped produce the lending bulge. But we have been out there aggressively. We had the money to lend and not a lot of problem assets to deal with, he adds. While loan volumes were ticking down slightly at many of the other community banks, their aggregate total assets were rising by 1.8% to nearly $5 billion. At Fuquay Varina-based Fidelity Bank, for example, both total assets and deposits climbed by nearly 5% during the 12 months, while net loans shrank by 4.6%, according to the FDIC. Five of the seven community banks posted nine-month profits as of September 30. The two putting up negative earnings were Chapel Hill-based Harrington Bank, which posted losses of $1.4 million in its latest FDIC call report, and Four Oaks Bank, whose nine-month loss totaled $1.6 million. In a report that paints a picture of banks essentially holding the line, one trend is boding well for the future. The asset quality of Triangle Bank portfolios has been mending. In the third quarter of 2011, non-performing loans and other problem assets made up 5.63% of all Triangle Bank assets. A year later, that number has fallen to 3.01%. The lowest of any region of the state, says Monroe Securities analyst Jeff Adams. It's been a marked improvement, says Adams. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, Ferris Wheel Giant Movie Screen, Part of City's Winterfest. Raleigh is in the mood for the holidays, and downtown will invite youngsters of all ages to the city's annual Winterfest Festival that will kick off on December 1 with an opening celebration from 3 p.m. until 9 p.m. The opening celebration will include bands, choirs, and other entertainers, a tree lighting ceremony, Santa's Village, sledding ramps, and carriage rides. New to the event this year will be a carousel and a Ferris wheel and a 42-foot outdoor movie screen showing the holiday movie The Polar Express. The opening event is free and will also include the opening of the downtown ice rink that will be open through the end of January. Cost to skate or fall is $8. Title sponsor is AT&T. Rick Rudman, the CEO of Beltsville, Maryland-based Vocus Incorporated, the company that bought Morrisville-based iContact, has upped his stake in the company. Security filings show Rudman acquired 70,000 additional shares, increasing his stake to 715,185 shares that are worth more than $1 million. Tom Roderick, an analyst with Stifel Nicolaus & Company, notes that such purchases communicate confidence to investors. Such insider buying is typically viewed by investors as a bullish sign, he told Reuters. North Carolina's late Secretary of State, Thad Yorr, used to refer to himself as the oldest rat in the barn, meaning that he was the last of an old guard of yellow dog Democrats who once ruled the state and included Jim Graham and Harlan Boyles. But how did folks perceive Boyles, Graham, and Yorr as they aged? A new study concludes that people are treated based on the way they act. Behave like an old person and you'll be treated like an old person, and vice versa. When people in their 80s or 90s exhibited characteristics that society tends to associate with people who are not old, such as being aware, active, safe, or independent, they were viewed and treated as not old, concludes Oregon State University researcher Michelle Barnard. In this way, they were able to age without getting old. Barnard conducted in-depth interviews with consumers in their late 80s and their family members. While acting young can result in a person being treated with respect and dignity, acting old in this country means the opposite. Our society devalues old age in many ways, and this is particularly true in the United States, where individualism, self-reliance, and independence are highly valued, Barnard said. Almost every stereotype we associate with being elderly is something negative, from being crotchety and unwilling to change to being forgetful. So, by all means, do not act your age. Scott Bartley Goodson has sold court reporting services in Raleigh to Fusion Court Reporting. CRS has been in business since 1969 and will continue to operate under its own name. The company incorporated as Transcription Services Incorporated in 1977. About 20 people work in its office on Wade Avenue in Raleigh. Fusion employs about 50 people elsewhere. Goodson bought the company several years ago as an investment and sold it to go back to work full-time as an attorney, says Craig Saunders, president of Atlanta-based Fusion. Law firms typically hire court reporters in the middle stages of litigation to transcribe depositions. Court reporters also transcribe trials and other court and administrative proceedings. Two universities received approval for construction work. UNC Chapel Hill will replace the vivarium equipment in the Mary Ellen Jones Building, built in 1978, 223,994 square feet, 11 story, and Taylor Hall, built in 1969, 72,274 square feet, 6 stories, with modern space and energy efficient equipment. This project will also replace the animal watering system in the Thurston Bowles Building, built in 1995, 161,611 square feet, 7 stories. The project is estimated to cost $4.8 million. NC State will add a 1,145 square foot floor to the Center for Marine Sciences and Technology in Morehead City, built in 2000, 51,000 square feet and 4 stories, to house the Marine Magnetic Resonance Imaging and Spectroscopy Laboratory Facility. That project is estimated at $502,340, funded partly through a National Science Foundation grant. NC State will also renovate 3,027 square feet in the McKimmon Center, built in 1976, 100,447 square feet, 2 stories, to convert the existing Corner Cafe into a new coffee and sandwich venue. The project is estimated to cost $455,058. Biz doesn't worry too much about national security issues, but takes note when Deputy Secretary of Defense Ashton B. Carter comes to town. Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy will host Carter on Thursday, November 29, as part of the Von der Heyden Fellows Program Endowed Lecture Series. Carter will talk about national security challenges and issues such as the upcoming budget sequestration cuts with Peter Fever, professor of political science and public policy at Duke. The event is free and open to the public with a reception in the Sanford lobby at 4 p.m. and the talk in the Fleischmann Commons beginning at 4:45 p.m. Parking will be available in the Science Drive visitors' lot. Raleigh-based publisher Lulu.com has pledged $30,000 to Boise, Idaho-based Booklamp. Booklamp's Kickstarter campaign, The Game of Books, aims to encourage reading, and Lulu's pledge is about a third of what Booklamp is asking for on its crowdfunding website. Booklamp is the public face of the Book Genome Project, and it plans to build The Game of Books, an app in the form of a digital card game. The app, its creators hope, will promote young adult reading in schools and libraries by combining elements of Foursquare with Xbox Live-style gamer achievements such as badges. Gamification becomes a way to discover books you just might love and to connect with a new generation, Lulu Marketing's chief, Brian Matthews, says in a statement. Booklamp compares itself to Pandora.com, a website that matches music lovers to new music. Booklamp helps you find books through a computer-based analysis of written DNA, its website reads. Old-timers around here remember the time when there weren't many choices in country clubs. Carolina Country Club was about it. But in 1967, Cary got its own private club in the form of McGregor Downs Country Club, which is now celebrating its 45th anniversary. As part of the bash, the club is offering 1960s-themed food and beverage, a 1960s-style tennis tournament, and a 1967 golf scramble. The club was founded by Raleigh businessman Gregory Poole, whose son Gregory Poole Jr. recently recognized the contributions of L.T. McDuffie, who has been working at the club since the day it opened. Over in Chapel Hill, the Carolina Inn, for the 15th year, will be decked out in holiday decorations inspired by the traditional song, The 12 Days of Christmas. Visitors to the inn will be able to take in some events that are new for this year, including Elf on the Shelf, Sugar Plum Fairy Tea Party, and Seasons Wreathing. Back home, some favorites, including the 10th annual Gingerbread Village Display and walking tours with the inn's historian, Ken Zogri. Contributing to Biz were staffers Chris Bagley, Lauren Onsorge, Jason DeBrun, and Amanda Jones-Hoyle. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to is written by Amanda Jones-Hoyle with a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Grub Grabs Prime Site on Glenwood. Raleigh real estate developer Gordon Grubb has purchased a site near the Carolina Country Club that could be suitable for a smaller replica of the successful Gardens on Glenwood condo property he built 10 years ago. Grubb, president of Grubb Ventures, paid $2.4 million for the Kipdell Homes property across from the Glenwood Village Shopping Center and the Gardens on Glenwood condos at the Oberlin Road intersection with Glenwood Road with Glenwood Avenue. For the time being, Grubb says he will continue to manage the 128-unit apartment building that Kipdell Homes has operated for more than 30 years. The corporate office for Kipdell Homes will continue to lease space in the adjacent office building. But sometime within the next couple of years, Grubb expects to tear down the aging buildings and redevelop the property through a subsidiary called Glenwood Gardens LLC. Whether the property will be turned into upscale condominiums, like the Gardens on Glenwood, or upscale rental apartments will be determined by market demand and what kind of financing is available when that time comes around, says Ann Stoddard, Director of Development at Grubb Ventures. Right now, condos are just not in a position to be financed, Stoddard says. Could it be a for sale product in the future? Maybe. We'll have to see in a couple of years when we get more serious on the redevelopment. It's the same strategy Grubb used for his Country Club Homes rental community in the historic Hayes-Barton community. Grubb Ventures purchased 200 single-level apartment units in 2006 and has continued to manage and lease the property. The existing asset allows us to rent and evaluate the market and plan for redevelopment in the future, Stoddard says. The Kipdell site was the target of a redevelopment back in the 1980s when a hotel was proposed for the property. That project was ditched in the face of opposition from nearby residents who said a hotel would create too much in-and-out traffic at all hours of the day and night. It was at about that time that Grubb moved to Raleigh. I can safely say we won't be planning a hotel there, he says, adding that nothing is likely to happen for a couple of years. Fortunately, both projects stay pretty well leased. Grubb was the lead developer of the 91-unit Gardens on Glenwood condo community that was lauded with a 2003 Sir Walter Raleigh Award for Community Appearance from the Raleigh City Council. Almost all of the units were sold within 2 years of its construction in 2002 at prices that ranged from $350,000 to about $825,000 at that time. Jewel Parker, a real estate agent with Prudential York Simpson Underwood, has been involved in the project from the beginning and currently has 5 units listed for sale. Of the units, One of the units was sold for $595,000 in 2005 and is now listed for $745,000, but another was originally sold for $585,000 and is now listed for $600,000. We have had very good luck with the biggest units, she says. You would think the two bedrooms would sell quickly, but they do not. A lot of our buyers are people moving out of larger houses, and they want the bigger units. A couple of units have even sold for more than $1 million. Stoddard notes that Grubb has been talking with the owners of Kipdell Homes about a possible acquisition and redevelopment of the Glenwood Gardens apartment property for about 15 years. It's been one of those long-term conversations, she says. Carl Kip Young, president of Kipdell Homes, wrote in an email that the family chose to sell the property to Grubb Ventures because of its fine reputation as excellent investors. We are delighted to have completed this sale with Grubb Ventures. Kip Young runs the company that was founded by his late father, J. Carl Young, alongside his sister, Jenny Kelling. Kipdell Homes owns about 90 homes, duplexes, and multi-unit apartment buildings around Wake County, according to Wake County records. The company has been renting and managing real rental properties throughout the city since 1957. And as we move down the page, we have another article with a black border around it. Inside that border, the top half is a picture of a man in a white jacket, a lab coat, sitting at a desk in front of a computer. The caption reads, Hans Herfarth is the primary investigator at UNCH on the project. And then under that, in bold black lettering, the headline, Treatment, Pig Worms. UNC work focused on Crohn's disease. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a dateline of Chapel Hill. Prep your gag reflex. A treatment candidate for Crohn's disease is about to undergo clinical trials at UNC Chapel Hill. It's simple. Patients in the placebo trial get a tablespoon of saline. For those getting the actual treatment dubbed TSO, that saline will be accompanied by eggs, the eggs of parasitic worms found in pigs to be precise, and there are 7,500 such eggs per dose. TSO stands for Trichuris sui ova, a reference to the pig worms treating the patients. Are you saying yuck and shuddering? That's the reaction I had at first, laughs Bobby Sandage, CEO of Burlington, Massachusetts-based Coronado Biosciences. But the data looks really impressive, he says. Crohn's disease is a form of inflammatory bowel disease that typically affects the intestines. As with all autoimmune disorders, Crohn's causes the immune system to errantly attack healthy body tissue. In this case, the attack causes bleeding, diarrhea, and infections, symptoms unpleasant enough to put drinking the worms into a different perspective. Crohn's patients are typically treated with agents that suppress the immune system to suppress inflammation, notes UNC's primary investigator on the project, Hans Herfarth. The theory behind using the worms is simple. Your body recognizes parasites. It mounts an immune response to try to kill them or get it out of the body, Sandage explains, adding that the worms have their own defense mechanisms, mechanisms that evolved over hundreds of thousands of years. It responds with a set of proteins and peptides, dampening the response so it doesn't get rejected by the body. That response, researchers say, could be enough to put Crohn's disease patients into remission. That's the hope. While genetics contributes to the onset of Crohn's, there are environmental factors at play that have yet to be determined. Instead of looking for what patients are exposed to that could cause the disease, scientists at Coronado are looking at what patients are not exposed to, i.e. pig worms. It's called the hygiene hypothesis, a theory linking high rates of autoimmune diseases with Western society's seemingly obsession with sterile, germ-free environments. But why pig worms? Because they are harmless, he says, and are meant to live in pigs, not humans. Pig worms can only survive a few weeks in human hosts. That means trial patients will imbibe a tablespoon every 2 weeks. The trial eggs are harvested using proprietary filters and pig feces. Currently, the preparation process, which Sandage stresses is quite sanitary, happens in Denmark. The egg vials are then sent to UNC and more than 60 other centers participating in the Crohn's trial. Sandage and team see potential for their pig worms beyond Crohn's. Teams are already researching applications in arthritis and other autoimmune disorders. Herfarth references Humira, an Abbott Laboratories marketed autoimmune treatment, for everything from Crohn's to psoriasis. If TSO becomes as versatile as Humira, whose sales were nearly $8 billion in 2011, that would push it past Blockbuster and into the mega blockbuster range. Coronado obtained positive results from the Phase 1 clinical trial of TSO in February and is in the initiating phase. The Phase 2 trial at UNC is expected to commence in 4 to 6 weeks. Results from a European trial conducted by Coronado's German partner, Dr. Falk Pharma GmbH, will be combined with the U.S. research. Herfarth's group at UNC is comprised of 7 physicians, 5 coordinators, and several doctorate students. At any given time, between 5 and 10 trials for IBD happen at UNC, he adds, but this particular one is exciting, he adds, because it's uncharted territory. Company spokesperson Laura Colontrell-Radoque says the UNC study will be funded with a clinical study site contract from Coronado, but that it's too early for specifics. Coronado debuted on the public market at $8 a share in late 2011. As of September 30, Coronado's cash totaled $47.5 million. Giving lags for NCSU-UNC against peers. That's the headline on our next article, this one written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Chapel Hill. When it comes to gifts, donations, and the size of their endowments, North Carolina's two largest public universities don't rank highly when compared to their peers. In terms of gifts and pledges for the 2010 to 2011 school year, NC State University ranked nearly in the bottom quarter, and UNC Chapel Hill ranked well below the 50th percentile. Even when excluding private universities, which typically receive larger donations, UNC Chapel Hill still ranks in the lower half of its peer group. Comparing endowments tells the same story. Both NC State and UNC Chapel Hill rank below the 50th percentile of their peers, even when excluding private institutions. When budget staffers at the UNC system presented the numbers to members of the UNC Board of Governors Budget and Finance Committee, those listening to the report sat mostly quiet, just taking in the information without much comment. Paul Fulton, chairman of the committee, said he was surprised, especially by UNC Chapel Hill, noting that there was room for improvement at most universities. He suggested possibly expanding the fundraising offices, potentially hiring more staffers to increase giving. As for returns on investments, UNC Chapel Hill and NCSU have by far the highest returns among UNC system schools. At NC State, the Office of Development operates on a $7 million budget with a full-time staff of 112. It generates a return of $13.69 for every dollar invested. UNC Chapel Hill has a full-time development staff of 211 and a budget of $27 million. They generate a return of $10.22 per dollar invested. The UNC system average return is $5.12 per dollar invested. NC Central University receives a return of $2.93 per dollar invested. Charlie Perusi, UNC's chief operating officer, notes that because their offices are larger, the larger campuses are going to perform better on giving metrics, a point the data proves to be true. Most of the endowments for universities in the UNC system are managed by the UNC Management Company, a 29-person operation led by Jonathan King, with offices off Environ Way in Chapel Hill, very near the UNC system offices. As was the trend nationally, UNC reported poor returns for the 2011 to 2012 year after reporting good returns for the prior year. The National Association of College and University Business Officers, commonly called NACUBO, with headquarters in Washington, D.C., tracks endowments of more than 800 universities in the nation. In 2011, the average endowment recorded a return of 19%, but this past year the average return fell sharply to a negative. Even the largest endowments, those of $1 billion or more, had an average return of just 1.2% in 2012, according to the NAC-UBO Common Fund Study of Endowments. Both John D. Walda, NAC-UBO President and CEO, and John S. Griswold, Common Fund Institute Executive Director, say the larger endowments typically perform better. And our next article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, State Working to Measure Extent of Fraud Clawbacks. And along with this article, there's a picture of a line of people in an unemployment office. The caption reads, Lines were long for unemployment pay during recession. The effectiveness of a stepped-up effort by the state to recover $50 million in fraudulent unemployment benefit payouts won't be gauged until after the 2013 tax season. The Division of Employment Security, or DES, has sent letters to more than 19,000 recipients of allegedly fraudulent payouts, asking them to repay the money before the end of the year or face loss of any state and/or federal tax refunds they might have coming. Active checking of those names against state tax records has been going on for some time. The new twist in the recovery effort, says DES spokesman Larry Parker, will be the checking of the names against IRS records. A positive match will give the state access to federal refunds for the first time. And it begins at tax time in 2013, he says. People whose names are on the list and who are currently enrolled in state repayment plans will also face the loss of any state and federal tax refunds. DES scoured its computer records and other sources to come up with the list of 19,000 names. Parker says agency officials haven't estimated how many of those recipients will decide to pay up before the December 31 deadline. Expectations are that the initial recovery from the effort will be in the $15 million range, but recent changes in state law have extended the statute of limitations in the area and strengthened the penalties. With those additional tools in hand, Parker says officials will continue recovery efforts past tax season. Cleaning up the benefits system and recovering money has become a linchpin of DES reform, as officials look for ways to make the system solvent while also finding a way to repay $2.5 billion that North Carolina borrowed from the federal government to continue making benefit payments during the worst of the recession. Repayment options currently on the table range from increasing the taxes that 200,000 North Carolina businesses pay to support the system to the selling of a special type of unemployment insurance bond to raise cash on the investor market. Thus far, says Representative Dewey Hill of Whiteville, a member of the General Assembly's Revenue Laws Committee, no consensus has emerged on how to proceed on the debt repayment. But there will be some new people coming into town next year, and I'm ready to listen to their ideas, says Hill, referring to the results of the November 6 elections. North Carolina currently pays a maximum weekly unemployment benefit of $525 and an average weekly benefit of $291 for up to 26 weeks, says General Assembly fiscal researcher Cindy Averett. And our next article has the headline, A Home is a Home, Not a Business, Entrepreneurs Here Find. Recently opened Hub Raleigh provides a place for startups to get off the ground economically. And along with this article, there's a picture of two people casually dressed standing inside of a building at what looks like a bar. The caption reads, Liz Tracy, Community Manager with Hub Raleigh and CEO Justin Miller. This article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Raleigh. Garage startups are the norm in Silicon Valley, but getting caught running one in Raleigh might lead to hefty fines. Just ask Justin Miller, CEO of mobile app startup Deja Me, who after operating his business in his R4-zoned Raleigh basement for 2 years, got a knock on his door on a Tuesday in October. He said it was an anonymous tip, Miller says the inspector told him of the reason for his visit. Miller and his 12-person team were given until the first week of December to find a new place to do business or face an initial $100 fine, as well as fines of $500 per additional day of zoning violation. It was stressful, he says. While residential zoning may protect neighbors from unwelcome traffic in their subdivision, it can also have a negative side effect on the area's growth. That's according to Moffett Field, California-based entrepreneurial veteran and academic Vivek Wadhwa, who formerly called the Triangle home. In Silicon Valley, it's the norm, he says, referencing Black Box Ventures, an incubator where about a dozen people live and start companies. It's not just about the ease of walking the 3 feet from your bedroom to your office, he said. It's the cost. It used to be that you had to have venture capital, he says. You had to have a business plan. You had to do things big. Now you have startups in a basement who never really have to get out of their basements. Unless, of course, a zoning inspector says otherwise. It's why we're not Silicon Valley, Miller opines. Not that innovation doesn't happen here. Jesse Lipson, founder of ShareFile, which was acquired by California tech giant Citrix Systems, stands as an example that it does. But Lipson did not start his business out of his home. My mom told me not to, he laughs, but recognizing the realities and costs associated, he helped start the outfit that would ultimately be Miller's savior, Hub Raleigh. This gives entrepreneurs options, he says. Hub Raleigh, a new co-working space on Hillsborough Street in downtown, has both private office suites and open space for entrepreneurs looking to break out of the basement. This is one way Raleigh grows, co-founder Jason Wyden said, at the Hub's opening. His goal isn't just to grow the individual startups, but to grow Raleigh itself. It's a cheaper alternative to finding a standalone office and to a way to be compliant with Raleigh's zoning ordinances, which do not allow people other than family members who reside on the premises to be engaged or employed in the business. Raleigh is not alone with the restrictions. Cary, Chapel Hill, Morrisville, Wake Forest, and Durham all have similar policies in place, give or take a few semantics. Other tech hubs, Austin, Texas, and Boston being notable ones, have similar ordinances in place. David Vosbrink, communications director for the city of San Jose, says city regulations define a family as whoever lives in the home. You don't have to be related. That makes it possible for entrepreneurs to open up their homes to employees as places to both live and work. It's a growing trend Wadhwa sees in the valley. Raleigh zoning inspector Robert Pierce says home occupancy businesses in the capital city can be run by a maximum of 4 unrelated people who live in a single-family dwelling. Raleigh does define a family. If everyone living at the home business is actually related, code would make an allowance for more employees, provided the entity has a home occupancy permit and a business license. And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Strong Numbers Could Rev Up MLM's Vulcan Takeover Bid. With purchase tied to share prices, movement in markets important for potential transaction. And along with this article, there's also a picture of a large truck standing next to a large mountain of dirt. The caption reads, One of Martin Marietta's big trucks gets ready for a new load of rock. Martin Marietta Materials Incorporated's unexpectedly strong growth last quarter could bolster the company's chances of acquiring its larger rival in the aggregates industry, analysts say. Raleigh-based Martin Marietta, the nation's second-largest producer of sand and gravel for construction, launched a hostile takeover bid for Birmingham's Vulcan Materials Company in December. It withdrew the bid following a court order in May, but could now reinstate it. Martin Marietta reported third-quarter net income of $63.7 million on November 6, a 27% gain from the third quarter of 2011. Its shares gained 2.3% in value that day. Analysts have been comparing Martin Marietta's performance and share prices with Vulcan since December. On November 8, Vulcan reported profit of $14.3 million, down by 29% from the third quarter of 2011. The decline came largely from one-time items, but the results fell well short of what analysts had expected, and its shares edged down that day to $46.01. The company's share prices are important because Martin Marietta was using its own shares as currency in its bid for Vulcan. A higher price for Martin Marietta puts that company in a stronger position to bid for Vulcan, especially when that company's shares are lower, says Catherine Thompson, an aggregates industries analyst in Nashville. The company's closing share prices on November 20 suggested that Martin Marietta might have to raise its bid by about 13%. The implied premium ranged from 12% to 15% through most of October. My thought is that Martin doesn't want to pay that valuation for Vulcan, says Garrick Schmoa, an analyst with Longbow Research in Cleveland, Ohio. The company's third quarter results also seem to buttress arguments by Martin Marietta CEO Ward Nye that his company is a better performer than Vulcan. Martin Marietta reported a gross profit margin of 20.3% for the first 9 months of the year, compared to 13.9% for Vulcan. Martin Marietta is significantly smaller than Vulcan, with about $1.56 billion in revenue in the last four quarters, compared to $2.45 billion for Vulcan. Nye said in March before the court order that an acquisition of Vulcan could lead his company to add about 50 positions to the 200 now at its Raleigh headquarters. Nye and other Martin Marietta executives have declined to discuss any renewed acquisitions plans, and Thompson says she would expect a renewed attempt at an acquisition to be quite different from the earlier bid. Nye took his case directly to Vulcan shareholders after talks between the two management teams stalled in mid-2011, according to court testimony. Thompson says it's more likely that Nye would resume or has already resumed negotiations with Vulcan management rather than risk another protracted public clash. Thompson rates both stocks buy and says the companies stand to benefit as state governments begin to make use of funds from a transportation bill that cleared Congress last summer. Any bid by Martin would probably include cash or other components, in contrast to the one-for-two share swap Martin Marietta offered in December, she says. To be near a new partner, company moves here from Chicago. And that's the headline on this article, written by Lauren K. Onsorge, with a Dateline of Raleigh. Beacon Biomedical is in love, at least as far as a company is able to emote, and it's in love with North Carolina. The medical device outfit, previously based in Chicago, has officially moved to Raleigh to be closer to its newest marketing partner, Durham-based Chesson Labs. Beacon hopes that by exclusively marketing Chesson's two products, one for hospital wound care, the other for veterinary use, it will find a path to growth. The corporate love ballad got its start in April 2011. That's when Beacon licensed a wound dressing called Stacilon from its first Triangle Love, Research Triangle Park-based Integrian. The partnership introduced Beacon to North Carolina, CEO Richard Kindle says. Stacilon served as Beacon's initial investment because it provides a low-cost but effective alternative to devices already on the market, Beacon board chairman Peter Beamstorber said at the time. The dressing developed by Integrion in collaboration with UNC Chapel Hill aims to control bleeding in trauma wounds with a dual-fiber hemostatic material and would be the first of three products marketed through Beacon. Kendall says that by moving Beacon to Raleigh, commercialization, manufacturing, and development will all take place in North Carolina. Scott Newville, CEO of Chesson Lab, says Beacon's technology is complemented by Chesson's NuvaDerm technology. We kind of call it a match made in North Carolina, he laughs, explaining that NuvaDerm, Chesson's liquid bandage, was the topic of conversation when he was introduced to Beacon's Kendall through an acquaintance. Us having a liquid bandage, them having this wound dressing that stops the bleeding, it was a very synergistic relationship in that each party alone was certainly not greater than the sum of the two companies together, he says. Thus, a professional partnership was born, both through NuvaDerm and NuvaVet, the veterinary product. Since that time, we've continued to work together on the product side of things and the market side of things, Newville says, and this month Kendall moved the Beacon operation to Raleigh permanently and plans to look for more partnerships in North Carolina. The decision was an easy one for us, Kendall says, adding that research and development around Integrion's platform stayed in North Carolina, and the move was the only missing piece. It just made it obviously a simple decision to move everything to Raleigh. Everything includes five full-time employees. Kendall hopes to double in size by the end of the year, propelled by the marketing partnership. Beacon is privately funded and expects to be profitable in 2013. A new manufacturer is also on board, a company right outside of Raleigh, he says, though he won't be specific. We're looking at 2013 being our breakout year, Kendall says. The past year has been a lot of introductions. Both products were introduced to the market in 2012, meaning it's now time to market and improve. We have both products, NuvaDerm and Stacilon, very well positioned to have a very strong 2013, he says, adding that currently the three products have equal market play. The next step is full-blown commercialization, he says. We are aggressively forming distribution partners out in the market and seeking strategic partners. He's looking for partners with success in a specific applicable market, such as emergency medicine or surgical care, and of course a presence in North Carolina. Integrion and Chesson products are marketed as part of a portfolio and could eventually work together on the development side, but that would involve the regulatory process, he cautions. And in the spotlight section, a spotlight on the law, there's an article written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Lobbying, a Whole New Game in Raleigh. The 2012 election results put North Carolina's businesses and industry associations in a better position to influence legislation than at any point in a generation, say lobbyists and other observers. It's conventional wisdom that businesses are likely to benefit from having Republican Pat McCrory in the governor's mansion and expanded GOP majorities in both houses of the General Assembly. McCrory and many other candidates ran on pledges to push for tax cuts and lighter regulation, after all. And the unusually large numbers of new legislators present fresh targets for corporate lobbyists, say those lobbyists and political scientists. About 60% of the General Assembly's members will start their first or second terms in January. Unofficial election results suggest that House of Representatives will have freshmen in about 38 of its 120 seats. Republican victories in November 2010 swept in a wave of GOP freshmen, both in North Carolina and nationwide, and newly redrawn districts pitted several Democratic incumbents against one another in primary races, the result of a post-census redistricting process that was dominated by Republicans. In Wake County, State Representative Greer Martin retired after being drawn into a House district with fellow Democrat Deborah Ross. And an unusually large number of retirements was an equally large factor, says Connie Wilson, a lobbyist and former state representative from Mecklenburg County. Wilson calls it a clean slate. There won't be as much legislative knowledge base as in the past, so there will be a lot of introductory meetings and a lot of getting people up to speed, she says. Those meetings are just as important in state capitals as in Washington, D.C., and particularly in North Carolina and other states with relatively short legislative calendars and small legislative staffs. Members of Congress often have staffs of a dozen or more to research policy issues, usually including a couple of legislative veterans who previously have served a senator or representative of the same party. In contrast, most North Carolina legislators have just a couple of aides. The dynamic provides an opportunity to be able to make your case, state your position, and hopefully be persuasive, says Andrew Taylor, a professor of political science at NC State University. The November elections follow a series of moves by lobbyists. The law firm Ward Smith, for example, recently hired Angie Harris to lead its government affairs practice. Harris brought lobbyist Heather Barrett and with her from the Raleigh office of Williams Mullen. That firm, in turn, recently brought on former Progressive Energy government affairs advisor Richard Zucchini. Wilson calls the moves a fairly regular game of musical chairs. Wilson, Taylor, and others say a potential legalization of hydraulic fracturing, a method of extracting natural gas from underground rock, is one of several energy-related issues likely to be on the legislative agenda in the next 2 years. Several say they see somewhat more scope for trimming the state's regulatory apparatus than they see for tax cuts, given the recently heightened attention on government budget deficits. Another new development has been Nexen Pruitt's expansion of its government relations practice in Raleigh, which has been in line with the local office's recent founding and subsequent growth. The Columbia, South Carolina-based firm announced the hiring of former Williams Mullen litigator and lobbyist Alexander Sandy Sands in August, former Governor James Holzhauser, and former State Supreme Court Chief Justice Beverly Lake are also relatively recent additions to the group. Holzhauer, a Republican who served from 1973 to 1977 and is on McCrory's transition team, noted that Republicans will control the governorship and both houses of the General Assembly for the first time since Reconstruction. "We've never been here before," Holzhauser says. "It's a new era, in a way." And with our remaining minutes, we'll read from TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here's some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Bankruptcy filings drop in western part of Triangle. Bankruptcy activity in Durham and Orange counties ebbed slightly in October, according to a report this week from the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Middle District of North Carolina. A total of 79 debtors sought relief from their creditors last month, down 15% from October 2011. All were individuals and couples, with no business entities included. A total of 789 initial petitions were filed in the court from November 2011 through October 2012, the smallest 12-month total since before the recession. The numbers peaked in early 2010. PPD to test oxygen biotherapeutics drug. Oxygen Biotherapeutics Incorporated has contracted with research organization PPD to test its lead product, which is a drug called OxyCyte. Oxygen, a Morrisville-based company, is hoping to develop OxyCyte as a drug that will help deliver oxygen to the brain and other injured areas of a body during traumatic situations. Ideally, the company hopes the product can reduce traumatic brain injuries. While the U.S. Navy also is partnering in the drug's development, it is still far from achieving the desired endpoints in clinical trials. PPD is one of the world's largest contract research organizations and specializes in testing all types of drugs and other products and reporting results back to the contracting company, in this case, Oxygen. Financial terms of the deal were not released. No tuition hike at William Peace University. William Peace University announced Monday it will freeze tuition for the 2013 to 2014 school year, keeping the price at $23,700. That's the same price students paid this year, a nearly 8% reduction from 2011 to 2012. This year, Peace, now co-ed and located in downtown Raleigh, enrolled 791 students, up 9% from 2011 to 2012. The Board of Trustees and University President Deborah M. Townsley cited the economy as a reason for freezing tuition. This year, the university has taken on various projects to reduce costs, another factor cited by Townsley in not increasing tuition. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Thank you.